writing should be a career that everyone can follow, especially writers of color.
When writers are united and when we speak with one voice, we wield incredible power and can accomplish amazing things.
We have the power to protect our economic security.
Because lower and mid-level writers deserve to be able to earn a living in this career. And because mini rooms majorly suck.
We have to stand up for writers, and we have to make writing a viable career for everyone.
That's a video made by the Writers Guild of America. They have authorized a strike. Nearly 98% of the members who voted yes. And that means if the WGA cannot negotiate a new contract, thousands of writers could walk off the job 2 weeks from now. It would be the first work stoppage in 15 years. The last one went on for more than 3 months and cost the local economy more than $2 billion. The first shows back then to go dark were late-night talk shows because of their daily tight turnaround. Here's Conan O'Brien in January of 2008 on his third night back on the air, sporting a very bushy strike beard in solidarity with his writing staff.
We support what they're fighting for. We want them back here very soon. They're a huge part of this show. In the meantime, I'm going to do my very best to entertain you without my writers. Now, of course, this is not always going to be pretty. Don't laugh at that. Don't laugh harder at that. No, it's not. It's not always going to be pretty. But on the bright side, our show now has all the excitement and unpredictability of an old dog trying to jump up on your bed and not quite making it.
Joining us to talk about this is Katie Kilkenny. She covers labor and union issues for The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Justin Halpern, member of the WGA West Board and a writer and executive producer and showrunner for ABC's Abbott Elementary and the animated series Harley Quinn on HBO Max. Hi, Justin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so Katie, 98% of the members who voted to strike. Was that expected?
It was expected that they would vote to authorize a strike, but the wide margin by which they did authorize a strike, I think, was not necessarily expected. It broke records for levels of participation in a strike authorization vote for the Writers Guild of America, and the turnout also broke records for the Guild. So nearly 79% of members eligible to vote did take part. So that part was really interesting to me.
Right. And so, Justin, what does that mean if there is no agreement in the next 2 weeks? Does that mean you and your fellow 9,000 plus writers will join the picket line, stop writing, and I guess stop receiving a paycheck?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I know of that 98% and the 9,000 people who voted, I know that not a one of us want a strike, but we also want to be paid fairly and not undervalued. And so if we are not able to reach a deal where we feel like we are, then yeah, that means we will stop writing and we will stop working and stop receiving a paycheck.
What is the main bone of contention? Or maybe there are several main bones of contention, but if you could winnow it down to a few, what are they, Justin?
Well, I think it's a pretty wide range of issues, but at the core of all of them is the sort of undervaluing of writer pay. I think over the course of the years, orders for shows have been shorter. The writing time is now shorter, and we're being paid less for doing some of the most important work you do on a series, which is, you know, creating the show. They put us in things called mini rooms where we're paid minimum, the minimum we can be paid as a writer, and we're supposed to come up with the sort of foundation for those shows. And so I think part of the issue is, you know, it's harder and harder to put together a year for most writers. I think there's a misconception that writers are paid this like wealthy sum, you know, they're very, very wealthy. And I think a percentage of our writers are, but there is a much larger percentage who are having trouble just putting together a full year to be able to live in Los Angeles.
Can you just go into detail about these mini rooms? Because I don't think a lot of people understand what they are and what that means in terms of your compensation.
Yeah, so a lot of times when a studio or a network is thinking about ordering a show, they won't order it to series anymore, or they won't order a pilot anymore. What they'll do is they'll sort of have the creator of the show and maybe three or four writers all come and be in what's called a mini room, which is, the idea is they'll break the show, they'll figure out the world of the show, they might even write a few scripts and break out the season, And all of that writing, because it's sort of disconnected now from producing, they're able to pay us guild minimum, which is means the least amount of money that they can pay us. So it doesn't matter if you're a 15-year veteran or you're just starting out, you're going to be paid the very minimum. And that work is some of the most challenging work you can do on a television show. And it's certainly the most important. And so that's then after they get all that data and the studio is able to see all these scripts and hear about the season, then they decide whether or not they want to order it to series. And that's just not fair.
And then some of the writers in these mini rooms might not be hired to work on the show, right?
Yeah, that's the other problem is that then if the show goes to series, most of those writers probably won't actually end up being on the staff of that show where they would be able to make their actual quote and writer producer fees and actually make a good living as a writer.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, the other big issue, as I understand it, and was also a big issue way back when in 2007, and that's residuals and how the landscape has changed with the streamers. Can you describe how it's different now when it comes to residuals?
Yeah, so back in the day, you know, you would have multiple windows by which writers could earn additional income. So a movie might be replayed on a television network, and then there was the home video market, you know, DVDs and VHSs, and those were all new points of payment. Now with shows and movies, you know, simply going onto streaming, the residuals formula is totally different, and there are just fewer points at which writers can be paid. So that has completely changed. And writers often, who are gig workers, essentially, relied on those residuals to be able to make up their earnings in between projects.
Right. And some of the networks will just pull their content, right, instead of paying residuals, like, or the streamers, rather. They'll say, okay, well, we're no longer going to air this show that might be popular because we might have to pay residuals.
That's certainly a phenomenon that's happening. I'm sure the networks and the studios would say that that's not the reason they're pulling those shows, but I would imagine that theoretically they would not have to pay those residuals, you know, if the shows are pulled.
Justin, what's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, our feeling is like, we're not asking to make money off things they're not making money off of. So if they are pulling a show because it's not making money for them, we're not asking to share in profits that aren't there. What we're saying simply is, if you are if this is a huge revenue generator for you, whether it be subscriptions or because of views, we would like to have an equitable share of that profit.
And Katie, what is the financial situation for the streamers and for the networks? The streamers say that they're having trouble making money, or at least Wall Street thinks they're having trouble making money. Is that true?
We do know that Wall Street has turned on the streaming model to a certain degree. And so the streamers are very much in cost-cutting mode right now. There have been a number of layoffs at some of the major companies. They are attempting to cut costs by taking things off of their services that they believe aren't performing, as Justin and you were mentioning. So, you know, they are in a mode of cost cutting because Wall Street, which had sort of buoyed up these streamers for so long based off of the potential there, has turned on them.
And so, Justin, what about that, the streamers are facing some difficulties? You're seeing a lot of job cuts. Disney cut 7,000, for example. Is that a risk that you're just going to see more job cuts and not a lot in terms of concessions on the part of the streamers, because they're going to say, look, we just don't have the money to do this?
Well, I think there's never been a time when we've sat down for a negotiation where they've said that this is a great time to be asking for more money. But what I would say is that, you know, they had a plan, a streaming model plan, and they were public about the fact that, you know, it may take a little bit to find profitability, and that this is what we're seeing now. But also a lot of them are, many of them are making profits right now. They're making profits right now. And I think there's a difference between needing growth year after year after year after year and showing this exponential growth, which is not feasible and which drives, you know, shareholder prices, versus like, they're making a large profit. Many of them are making a large profit. And, you know, the studios negotiate together. And we feel at the Writers Guild that if they choose to negotiate together, that we shouldn't be held to whichever one of them is going through the most financial burden at that moment. We, you know, they're negotiating together and many of them are doing very well. And we feel like we need to be that this is a perfectly good time.
You work for a network as well as a streamer. You work on Abbott Elementary on ABC and also Harley Quinn. And so is there a difference in your experience?
You know, I think that there's not a real difference yet. It's certainly like I've because Abbott Elementary airs on ABC, but then the next day it airs on Hulu. And then after the season's completed, it airs on Hulu and it airs on HBO Max. And I think that's part of what writers' concerns are, is that these shows are not just living in the one place that they first air. They're being monetized in many different ways across many different platforms. And because of that, it's generating income that that's just really never getting to us.
Do you get paid if it airs on a streamer after first airing on a network?
There is a residual model that we fought for in 2020 for television. There is a residual model that will pay us for it airing on the networks, but we don't airing on the streamers. It's not equivalent to what it used to be. It's less. But you know, part of the issue also is that we don't ever know how well it's doing on these platforms because no one gets to see that data. And so, you know, I think it becomes the situation where it's tricky to know if you hear it's a big hit, but then we're not seeing the residuals reflected in that way.
So, Katie, I imagine the studios are stockpiling all sorts of stuff in anticipation of this strike. They weren't taken by surprise either. So what can we expect as viewers if indeed the writers go on strike?
They are indeed. They stockpiled scripts. I've talked to attorneys who have said that they've looked at their filming schedules, and we're even in a kind of strike mode right now, according to certain sources, where basically studios and streamers have prepared so much that there's not a lot of work to go around at the moment. But what you can expect is that the late night hosts would go down first if a strike were to occur, because they rely on these sort of daily, weekly writing. We would imagine that there would be more reality and nonfiction content that would probably be aired. But also, you know, the streamers already have plenty of content on their platforms. So I don't know how much they would be adding new content on their platforms as much as resurfacing older content that might have new interest now.
More unscripted reality shows?
Potentially, yes. Yes. Mm.
Oh, lucky us. Okay. Katie Kilkenny covers labor and union issues for The Hollywood Reporter. Justin Halpern is a TV writer. He works on ABC's Abbott Elementary and HBO Max's Harley Quinn. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how an Adderall shortage revealed that lots of adults now have ADHD. We'll find out why next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Remember the Adderall shortage last fall? Adderall is the main drug that's used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and it's usually diagnosed in kids and teenagers. The pandemic hit, and then a surge of adults sought treatment for the disorder. But unlike for kids, there's no medical standard for diagnosing or treating ADHD in adults. Well, now psychiatry is trying to catch up. Joining me now is Yasmin Tayag. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers science and recently wrote about this. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, this Adderall shortage, has that been resolved by and large?
The FDA says that the Adderall shortage is resolved, but that's only for brand name Adderall. The generics, which are widely used, are still in short supply.
And is this because of this surge in demand, a big increase during the early years of the pandemic for adults?
Yeah, it's considered one factor leading into the shortage, but there are others, including manufacturing delays, labor shortages, and FDA and DEA regulations. And so, you know, it's a complicated picture, but it's certainly one of them.
And why would there be DEA regulations on this drug? Is it considered a serious drug?
Yeah, I mean, Adderall is considered a Schedule II drug, which puts it in the same class as cocaine and fentanyl. Wow. You know, it's addictive, and there are pretty good reasons to control the amount of drug that is out there.
What is Adderall? Is it basically speed?
It's a form of amphetamine. So, yes, in theory. Yeah, it's been widely used to treat ADHD for a long time, but it's not without its side effects. And it can be quite dangerous if it's not prescribed correctly.
Right. Why are more adults now demanding ADHD treatment, Adderall, other drugs?
There are a lot of reasons. One is that, you know, it's entirely possible that during the pandemic, people really did feel that they were having difficulties focusing, induced by the lockdown, induced by, you know, all sorts of emotional issues. But there's also rising awareness of this disorder in adults. And that's helping people, you know, realize their own symptoms. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, regulations had become a little bit more lax during the pandemic. And so this drug that was once quite difficult to get in the past for adults is now a little bit easier to access, in part because telehealth really boomed during the pandemic and people were able to get it online.
What is ADHD in adults and how does it differ from the diagnosis in children?
So a lot of the symptoms do overlap in adult ADHD and children's ADHD. It is a form of attention deficit and hyperactivity, but the symptoms can differ depending on the age. They don't always. So, you know, whereas a child might seem really hyper at school and unable to control their outbursts, it might manifest differently in adult. For example, an adult might not have so many physical symptoms, but internally maybe really struggling to focus or maybe having really racing thoughts. The big difference, at least in the way that psychiatrists look at it, is that when you're trying to diagnose it, you have to look at different parts of the person's life. Mm-hmm. So for a child, you would look at how they're doing at school or with their parents. Whereas for an adult, you might look at how they're doing at work or how they're able to keep up their relationships. And that's part of the problem. There's no real guidelines for adults. And so providers who are looking to give care to them don't really know where to look.
Interesting. So how is psychiatry, mental health, how are they trying to catch up? And as you say, there are no protocols for diagnosis and treatment. What's happening now?
Yeah, well, now that there is a realization in the field that there is a demand for help, there is a big push to try to create guidelines for providers that will tell them exactly, you know, what to do, what to look for, what kind of tests to use when they're trying to assess an adult with ADHD. And the hope is that having these guidelines in place will, you know, sort of standardize care across the board. So you're not going to get, you know, issues like sketchy telehealth services providing stimulants way too easily to adults. You know, there would be a little bit more standardization in how providers are expected to diagnose and treat patients.
And just to be clear, a lot of people are thinking, I think, that this isn't real, that it's just a symptom of our culture, our distracted online culture, that we all feel frazzled and that we can't concentrate. But this is something different.
Yeah, psychiatrists have recognized, you know, through research that adult ADHD is a real thing and it has been underdiagnosed for a long time. One of the things that the field has gotten wrong for so long is that it was believed that ADHD was a disorder that children would grow out of. But, you know, now they're realizing this is a lifelong disorder, and adults can be just as affected as kids.
Yasmin Tayag, staff writer for The Atlantic, where she is writing about Adderall and ADHD. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the merging worlds of autism, COVID, and vaccine misinformation.
The very notion that autism is a disease that has to be eradicated, when you frame it like that, you are undermining this neurodiversity movement.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For years, skepticism over vaccines and belief in the debunked claim that they can cause autism used to be a conspiracy mainly of the left. It was pushed by celebrities like Jenny McCarthy and embraced in some wealthy liberal enclaves such as Marin County up in Northern California. Well, then came former President Donald Trump.
2 years old, 2.5 years old, a child, a beautiful child, went to have the vaccine and came back, and a week later got a tremendous fever, got very, very sick, now is autistic. I only say I'm in favor of vaccines. Do them over a longer period of time, same amount.
Thank
but
you.
Just in little sections.
That's Trump during the second Republican presidential debate in 2015. As a longtime vocal skeptic of vaccines, Trump became the first sitting president to humor these conspiracies. Over time, his presidency kicked off a wider cross-pollination of vaccine skepticism and right-wing politics, one that was supercharged by the pandemic as the right embraced COVID conspiracy theories. Joining me now to talk about all this is Kira Butler, senior editor at Mother Jones. Hi.
Hi.
So this is really a story of how the autism vaccine skeptics cross-pollinated with the COVID vaccine skeptics, right?
Yeah, and even more than vaccine skeptics, I would say it was the folks who were believing in and peddling dubious autism treatments and supposed cures.
One of the women you profile is a woman you begin your story with named Stephanie Seneff, senior researcher at MIT, so obviously a serious scientist, and yet she is quite popular in anti-vaccine circles. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, so she's pretty interesting. She started off her career in the 80s and 90s at MIT. She was a pioneer in the burgeoning field of voice recognition. And she really was a very accomplished scientist in that field. Then in the mid-aughts, her career took an entirely different turn. She began to be kind of obsessed with the idea that glyphosate, this is a weed killer, it's known as Roundup. She believed that caused autism as well as a host of other neurological conditions. And she really turned away from her previous research and threw herself into this. And she was a popular speaker in these kind of fringe left circuits, you know, Weston A. Price Foundation, some kind of like, you know, organic food and lifestyle people were really into her work. But more recently, she has become popular on the right, and she has sort of incorporated into her theories about weed killers causing autism the idea that COVID vaccines are dangerous, and also the idea that exposure to this weed killer has somehow made people more susceptible to severe cases of COVID.
Wow. So here she is, a voice recognition scientist. How does she then cross into this obsession with glyphosate, this ingredient in Roundup?
I don't know her personal story of how she became obsessed with this, but it certainly does appear that it became all-consuming. She no longer is really active in her former field. She now has devoted herself just to this. And she became popular in this kind of left-wing, fringe left, I would say, environment, you know, groups that embraced organic lifestyle and, you know, non-GMO groups were all kind of avidly following her work. And then, you know, when COVID came along and you saw this kind of widespread embrace of the anti-vaccination and anti-science movement by the right wing. And, you know, that, to be clear, COVID sort of catalyzed that. It had been brewing, I would say, since shortly before Trump became president. But, you know, she really took advantage of that moment of widespread anti-science sentiment on the right. And she increased her audience that way. She has, you know, gone on the network of Stu Peters, who is this kind of far-right live streamer. She's teamed up with Peter McCullough, who's a very prominent anti-vaccine activist on the right. She has become really popular in these spaces. And it was interesting to me because I wanted to figure out whether her politics had changed. So I asked her. I emailed her, and she wrote back that, you know, she had been a lifelong Democrat. This is a woman who presumably lives or at least works in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Right. And she's still with MIT.
And she's still with MIT. Yeah. And she's been, like, you know, presenting with, like, organic gardening groups forever. And she told me that, you know, she has rethought her party affiliation and that she would probably vote for Ron DeSantis if he were an option for president for 2024.
Who has now come out against COVID vaccines.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about how she is an example of this broader movement that you write about. You also have Andrew Wakefield. He is the notorious British physician who kicked this whole thing off back in the 90s when he linked autism erroneously to the MMR vaccine. He was thoroughly discredited, even lost his medical license. He's viewed as a quack, and yet he reappears during COVID. What is he doing now?
Well, that's, you know, that's exactly what he did. He reappeared during COVID, and he was, you know, one of a number of anti-vaccine activists who was really emboldened by this kind of renewed energy behind the anti-vaccine movement. And he found a new audience in these folks who had, you know, been railing against public health, you know, for the last 1, 2, now 3 years.
So what does all this mean for these, you know, former anti-vaccine people in these liberal enclaves? Because, as you say, this is something that's really taken off on the right. Are they now, you know, making alliances across political lines, or did the original vaccine skeptics related to autism, the ones living in Marin County, Santa Monica, what have you, are they now rethinking their original opposition?
You can look at COVID vaccination rates, right? And whereas you mentioned Marin County, you know, that used to be a place where, you know, people would worry about measles, where, you know, a lot of incoming kindergartners would have medical exemptions, or back when they allowed them, religious exemptions for vaccines. And yet Marin County was among the places where COVID vaccination rates were the highest. But, you know, I mean, I think it is such an individual question. You know, you'd really, somebody really has to, you know, go to one of these places and do some deep interviews with people.
What is this doing politically? Like, does this new movement see itself as politically powerful? And is it? I mean, you do see Robert Kennedy Jr., who doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning anything, announcing, though, that he's running for president.
Yeah, he's kind of a weird one because he's running as a Democrat. So, I mean, good luck, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on the other hand, you know, you have Ron DeSantis, who is courting this conservative anti-science, anti-vaccine movement pretty clearly. And, you know, you have Marjorie Taylor Greene. You have, you know, probably politicians who are not household names, who are fighting to expand exemptions for vaccines, not only COVID, but routine childhood vaccinations. And, you know, I watched a bunch of footage from these autism conferences, and at one of them you had Del Bigtree, who's the guy who is from the Informed Consent Action Network. He was one of the people behind the movie, the anti-vax movie, Vaxxed. He was kind of gloating during the speech. He was like jumping up and down on the stage, you know, saying, "We won, like the politicians are coming to us, like they need us, they want us." And I kind of think he has a point.
Wow. What is this doing for people who have autism, who are really saying, you know, if they have mild autism or on the spectrum, that they shouldn't be medicalized, that they should be celebrated as neurodiverse? I mean, in many cases, they don't even think that they have a disease, and they, you know, they don't by many definitions. Of course, there are people with severe autism who have a different set of circumstances, but how do they fit into this whole picture?
For this piece, I talked to so many autism advocates, and their worry was that, they had a few worries. One was that the folks who are peddling these autism, supposed autism treatments and cures, the very notion that autism is a disease that has to be eradicated or driven out of somebody, you know, when you frame it like that, you are kind of undermining this neurodiversity movement, the movement of autistic people and their advocates who say that, you know, look, human brains vary widely, and autism is, first of all, there are many different kinds of autism, and, you know, these are just variations on the human neurological system. It's not a disease, it's just different. And that, you know, we can be working to help the world understand that rather than to kind of make autistic people conform to neurotypical norms. So that was one worry that they had. Another thing that they pointed out, and really this was sort of the point of my whole piece, was that, you know, you have this polarization. You have on the right this notion that of autism as a disease, and then you have on the left the neurodiversity movement. And, you know, like so many other, fill in the blank, any other issue that has become politically polarized over the past few years, it's not helpful. It breaks down conversations. And, you know, in this case, it's autistic people themselves that are being caught in the middle. Hmm.
Well, Kira, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Fascinating story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kira Butler, senior editor at Mother Jones, where you can go online and read her article, How MAGA Conspiracies Infected Autism Groups. Coming up, Rafael Casal, the star of Blindspotting. That's a TV series set in Oakland. He's here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
I have never, ever been happier.
There is a 7-year-old custodian who voted for Kanye teaching social studies right now.
All right, thanks, boss. I appreciate you.
For you.
That was the greatest night in the history of television. WandaVision.
All right, it took Rafael Casal about a decade to produce the movie Blindspotting, along with his best friend, David Diggs, of Hamilton fame. He also co-wrote and starred in the 2018 movie. Rafael Casal plays Miles, the short-tempered, reckless friend of Colin, played by David Diggs. The film pays homage to Oakland. It explores interracial friendships, and it critiques policing, the prison system, and, of course, gentrification in Oakland. 5 years after the film's release, Blindspotting is now a TV series on Starz, and it continues the story of Miles, still played by Casal, as he lands in jail and leaves his girlfriend to care for their son without him.
See you in 2 weeks for the first family visit.
Yes, you will.
Because, girl,
when you get here in 2 weeks, we are about to...
Everybody can hear you on speakerphone.
Hey,
things are tough. I get that. You could stand to be a little more fun.
I'm fun. It's time to do the pinata. Everything is okay.
Season 2 of Blindspotting kicked off last week, and Rafael Casal, who also writes, directs, and executive produces the show, joins me now. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me. I love that clip. It just ends with Jasmine yelling, everything's okay, and clearly it's not.
clearly it's not, and clearly she is losing her mind. So your character, Miles, is he losing his mind as he's incarcerated in San Quentin? Because he seems kind of chill.
I think that's all a front. You know, I think he's putting on a good show for his family so that he's not adding to all their worry about the circumstance that they find themselves in. But no, I think he's coming undone, too. And that's a lot of what season two is about.
So he has this kid. His name is Sean. And Ashley is, as I said, trying to raise this kid on her own with a bunch of friends, as well as your character's mom, who's played by Helen Hunt. And in this episode, I'm just going to play a clip from the first episode of season two. In this episode, she is trying to throw the perfect birthday party for their son, Sean, and everything goes awry.
We're fine. We've got karaoke, and we have food for kids, and we have liquor for the adults, and we have games, and we even have a carousel, and we have a steam train reserved just for us today. And Trish is gonna bring a piñata.
Oh, Ash, breathe, okay? It's just, it's his first birthday without his dad, and I just need everything to go perfectly.
Sean!
Oh my God! Oh,
Jesus! Oh, Ash, your car just got bit.
What?
Okay, so describe what happens at that birthday party and why everything goes wrong.
Oh, everything goes wrong. I mean, I think anytime you need everything to go right, that's when everything goes wrong. But she's just, you know, we're coming back into Ashley and she's just hitting her breaking point. You know, mm-hmm. she's leaned on everyone. She's tired. She's holding too much in her arms all the time. And she's just starting to snap at people and just kind of hit her final burnout. And so we come back in season two with the first episode of the moment where she kind of hits a wall.
Right. And so then her son goes off with these other kids. Maybe they're a little bit older than Sean. And how old is he, by the way?
Sean is turning 7 in this birthday.
Okay, he's turning 7. So his friends seem a little more, I guess, worldly, and they go off with him and take him to the train to go on a train ride. But then they go off to smoke weed, I guess. And he goes on the train by himself.
Anybody out there? How are we going to do this?
And he's holding this stuffed animal that his dad, made for him. And then all of a sudden, the stuffed animal turns into a big creature, like something out of Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak. Yeah. Was that your inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the few examples to, you know, to have as a reference point. We got to work with the Henson Company on that, and that was a dream come true for us. We wanted to create this sort of, you know, that 7-year-old, that 6 to 7, 7 to 8-year-old range for little boys, and sometimes where they're pulling away from their moms and they think they're adults now and they start kind of grasping for independence. And so we love this idea that, like, because his father's not around, he's both like sort of stuck between his, you know, still being kind of like this sweet, innocent kid and also trying to be like too cool for school. And he gets really scared on this train, and he has a stuffed animal from his dad that he probably thought was too nerdy when he first got it, too like much of a little kid thing. But he needs protecting in this moment. And so it turns into this giant lion that he calls a bear.
It's really cute. But also what struck me from that scene was he tells the other kids that his dad, is in prison in San Quentin. And they'll go, cool.
Like, yeah, it's that thing when you're young, it's, you know, like street cred is important. You know, you're bragging about how tough or how cool or how down, you know, your family is. And there is this like novelty to it. And so we're just kind of exposing the audience for the first time of like, hey, he's actually getting points, like cool points from his friends for his dad being in prison. And how does that play in his life, you know?
Yeah. Is it also that it's not that out of the norm?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, just kids in the Bay Area in general, and I think kids all over the country. I mean, there's 2 million people in prison. There's 5 million in the prison industrial complex in the country. Like, there are so many kids with family members in prison that, like, it becomes kind of normal for some folks.
And so they have this family visit, and they get to stay in a pretend house on the prison grounds for the weekend, the three of them. Is that a real thing?
That's a real thing. There's not very many prisons that do it, but San Quentin Penitentiary, a state prison in California, is one of the prisons that has the weekend. It's like a weekend cabin visitation for families, for married couples that are trying to keep the family dynamic strong while the father is in prison. And so we just modeled this episode and a bunch of the arc of this season off this real program that exists.
Wow. So what is that supposed to do? Is it supposed to, I don't know,
I don't think it's so much about easing the tension in the prison. It's more, I think, about maintaining someone who's incarcerated's relationship with their family. So when they come out, they still have strong bonds with their partners and their children. You know, I'm sure the whole point of the program is to not have people come back to prison. You know, yeah. The recidivism rate is so high. I think they're like, well, here's one way that maybe if people stay connected to their loved ones and have, you know, physical contacts and can hug their kids and kiss their partners, that, you know, there's some semblance of normalcy that gives them hope.
Mm. Right. And so in this visit, and this is from episode 3, I don't want to give too much away, but Sean, who's of mixed race because you're white, he uses the N-word. And then you and Ashley, his mom, try to teach him why that's not okay, even though some of the black adults in his life use that term. And then you play this game, and I want to just play a clip from it to illustrate something that is probably hard for him at age 7 to understand, and that is systemic racism.
Oh, look at all this gold. Look at this old sack of generational wealth. I'm going to throw this over my shoulder. I'm going to go start a family empire.
Is it my turn yet?
No. And that, my boy, is systemic inequality. That's one of the many reasons why you can't say that word we were talking about, okay? This game takes place in 1849. It's not going to be another 16 years before you're even in the game. And when you're finally in it, it's still totally rigged.
Hmm. So how did you come up with that idea? Because it's something, it's really an important topic, but you don't want to sound like you're lecturing the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's a big theme throughout the show. I think it plays a little heavier in season 2 about this parallel of the gold rush to this moment in gentrification in Oakland and the idea of an influx of people and the way that shifts culture. But I think, you know, some of this was also coming up in our real lives of like, what's the age where this pops up out of kids' mouths and how do you have that conversation as a parent or as an uncle or whoever? And so we had parents in the writer's room and we, you know, obviously talked to a lot of people who've had to have those conversations with their kids. And we were like, well, we got to show the fumble. We also have to show like the way in which progressive politics would come out of a parent's mouth if you're from the Bay Area and the way that we were raised and the way that we talk about it, and trying to use metaphors and, you know, like a board game, mm-hmm. like Gold Rush Hour to come up with an explanation. But ultimately, like, he doesn't get it. You know, it's still over his head. And I think the fun of the episode is the fumbling of their parenting while they're trying to find a rhythm.
Right. And then they go into this really interesting, I guess, magical realism where they try to explain to him the whole history of black people in America and racism. And it's really interesting how you portray that. I wanted you to talk about your stylistic devices, because in many of the episodes, there is this turn into, I guess, magical realism or a dance number or a poetry jam or something like that.
Yeah, we have two big conventions on the show. One is direct address to camera, and it's in verse. What we mean by in verse is like it has a rhythm to it or a meter to it. And then we have movement, which is like it's anything from like a full dance number to just like really heightened movement that elevates the world that we're in. And movement really comes in when something that is so hard to articulate through words needs to be expressed through the body or through movement. And that's a better medium to get the emotion across. And we usually always pair it with when the weight of the prison industrial complex is weighing the heaviest on the characters. And so that's kind of the rule for when it happens. And so in this episode, when they're trying to find the words at the end to tell the history, we knew if we did that literally, it'd be a 5-hour special on TV and we still wouldn't get to it all. But if we do it through movement and kind of tell the history, everyone can feel it a bit more, mm-hmm. without getting caught up on the language and is that factually accurate or is that the way I would phrase it? But instead, we just kind of told it on the body through our amazing dancers, all directed by Jess Wu Calder. That episode's her directorial debut. And then poetry I always think of the poetry as these like poetic journal entries that Ashley is making to give to Sean when he's old enough to understand what happened when he was like 7 or 8 and his dad got sent to prison. And so I think she uses the audience kind of like staring into a journal that nobody else can read.
And you also include cameos from some Bay Area hip hop royalty, like Too Short, E-40. They're in the season.
Oh, yeah.
How did you get them to participate?
We've been in the music scene for a long time, so some of them we just know. And then I think between the film and the popularity of the TV show, like we've just gotten on their radar. And I think the fun is, you know, Bay Area artists like to support each other. And so, you know, we didn't have to pull teeth or anything. I think they understood the synergy between music and film. I mean, those two mediums go hand in hand. And so, you know, we asked E-40 to come and to come play with us. And he said yes. And we asked Too Short, and Dante Bosco, who's also from the Bay, comes and plays with us. P-Lo, who's a big rapper in the Bay, came and played with us. Guap Ed. Like, we have a lot of Bay Area support. And that really is a lot of the fuel of the show.
So last time you were on the show is, it was pre-pandemic. And I think it was in 2018. And we talked a lot about gentrification and how your film was aimed at depicting the Oakland you knew and loved in a way you thought the media hadn't depicted it before. I'm wondering now how that's changed. How has Oakland changed and your view of the city, if it has?
I think the hardest thing is like when I come to the Bay, because I live in Los Angeles now, because that's where my employment happens. the Bay for me is where I go see my parents and I see my niece and my sister and my friends I grew up with. And, you know, so I get this kind of like in and out experience of like coming in, getting this big update and then leaving and coming in. So I think the changes are really, really noticeable for me. Like, you know, I'm not sitting in the boiling water, not noticing it getting hot. Like I really see the shift. And so there's parts of it that I love, and I'm so excited that certain things have persevered and stayed. And there's certain elements of Bay Area culture that's never going to go anywhere. But also like, it's just a different place than it was when we grew up. Oakland's different, Berkeley's different, San Francisco's completely different. You know, the Bay that's in my head is not the Bay that I see when I'm driving around. And I think the biggest thing is I just have to reconcile those two things, that like the nostalgia from your childhood and the like the place that it was at and the people that were there have gone off and created those things in other cities and other places. And there's great nostalgia, and there's a new thing here now that is also beautiful, but it's fundamentally different.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like Sean growing up, and he's living in a fantasy land right now, I guess, sometimes with his bear Fizzly.
Yeah. I mean, Fizzly really is the representation of his absent father, right? Like he's living he's living with a safety blanket of a stuffed animal because his protector is not there. I think there's probably to a certain degree, like me and David live with like a safety blanket of an Oakland that no longer exists, of a Berkeley that no longer exists, because it makes us feel good, you know, to think that it's still there. But a lot of times the places where it feels the most like that still is in the movie and in the show, because we can bring things back to life that are gone.
Well, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Really appreciate it. I love your show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it being here.
Oh, my pleasure. That's Rafael Casal, creator, co-writer, director, and star of Blindspotting. It airs Friday nights at 9 on Stars and streams on the Stars app.
I go on and on. Can't understand how I last so long. I must have superpowers. Rap 225,000.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
And for the last 300 months, I made 16 albums with me on the front. And they bump. Where you get your beats, I heard 90.